We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
And after decades of lock 'em up and throw away the key prison policy, treating juveniles as adults, there are at last some signs of positive change. Though we say the goal is not only public safety, but rehabilitation of offenders, as of now, American juvenile justice policies actually hamper rehabilitation and the correction of difficult characters. Nearly 250,000 young people are tried, sentenced, or imprisoned as adults every year across the United States. On any given day, 10,000 youth are detained or incarcerated in adult jails and prisons. In 1993, one of those youths was Carter Kane Reed, who at age of 16 had stabbed another teenager to death in a high school classroom in a town outside of Boston. Convicted of second-degree murder, Carter Reed was sentenced to life in prison. In her new book, Boy with a Knife, author Jean Traunstein tells the very personal story of murder, remorse, and a prisoner's fight for justice. Traunstein is the author of the highly praised Shakespeare Behind Bars, The Power of Drama in a Women's Prison, and has written many articles about prison issues for many publications, including the Boston Globe, and has been featured on many radio and TV shows. Jean Traunstein, thanks so much for being with us today on Keeping Democracy Alive. Tell us.
Thank you.
Tell us first.
Nice to be here, Bert.
Well, tell us first how this book came to be. That's an interesting story in and of itself.
I teach at Middlesex Community College in Lowell, and I had a class called Voices Behind Bars. Was getting ready for that class, and I got a letter in the mail from a prison. And when you get a mail from the prison, it always has a stamp on the back. It's very intimidating. But I opened the letter, and it was from a young man. At the time, Carter was 31. He had spent almost 15 years behind bars. And he was asking for help for a friend of his, for parole. He saw my name on the book jacket and of Shakespeare Behind Bars and wrote me a letter. And I really didn't have the intention of writing back particularly, but I thought I'd be polite. I answered his letter. I said if I could find a student to do some work. It was the end of the semester. I'd see if I could get some help for him. But what was amazing is that he was so smart, so intelligent. I was drawn to that letter, so I Googled him and found out, you know, as we can in a second, everything about a person, and his crime was horrific.
Yes.
So I thought, how could a person who sounded like this on the page be like that, and or have done that, really, is the question. And that drew me into communicating with him.
So who is the target audience? What is your purpose in getting this out there? It's quite a story.
That's a good question. It took me about 7 years to write this book, and it took a lot of, first of all, getting to know Carter and his story to get me interested in juvenile justice. So Carter is just a lens through which I want to show people what the Supreme Court has said, which is that even a child who commits even the most heinous of crimes is capable of change. That's the first thing. Second thing is that because children are capable of change, I don't believe from my research that they should go to adult prisons and jails. I do think there are other ways to help kids, and if we need to contain them, certainly other ways to contain kids.
Mm-hmm.
And third of all, I really want to be a voice in a conversation, so I've tried to make the book as accessible as possible so that as many people as possible will read the book and not feel that they're, even though it's well-researched, I think I have over 450 notes, it reads like a story.
Yeah, you got to have it readable, otherwise, yeah, it doesn't communicate all that well. What was the mandatory sentence for juveniles convicted of murder back when it happened in 1993?
Well, 1993 was an interesting year because it was the year before the peak of the super predator craze. We hear about this now because it's in the news again,
right.
But kids were, and this was a code for black kids,
yes,
the word super predator. And
absolutely.
Carter is not black. However, he was the benefit, I mean that sort of ironically, the benefit of the kind of justice meted out to black kids, which is far worse than the justice meted out to white kids. So at the time, laws were changing around the country to try to make it harsher for kids because there was a fear that crime would rise.
Right.
And so in almost every state, the laws were changed to send kids younger and younger to prison if they were accused of murder, to give them longer sentences. And in Massachusetts, the laws changed twice between 1990 and 1992, and then once again in 1996. So it all depended on whether you were tried as a juvenile, adjudicated, they say, as a juvenile, or tried as an adult. The sentence that one would get.
Yeah, it was a get-tough period. And as you mentioned, fear, as we know from so many issues, fear is incredibly powerful. And FDR, when he said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, it is incredibly powerful. It can cause great damage. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here. We're talking with author Jean Traunstein about her new book, Boy with a Knife, looking at juvenile justice or the lack thereof. He was painted by the media as a monster at the time. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the case in New Hampshire, in the Pam Smart case, in which the entertainment aspect, the high drama of the circus-like trial, really necessitated a conviction in the public eye. How, you know, it just wouldn't be a complete drama if she weren't convicted. How did that media spin affect the sentencing of this juvenile offender in 1993?
Well, I can't really say, I mean, I totally agree with you, Bert, but I can't say specifically that it changed something. But I do want to say that also having lived through the Philip Chisholm trial in Massachusetts, and I'm sure you've heard of that as well, but the portrait that is painted in the press of a child who is a monster is very specific. And the interesting thing is, even if a child, or in your case when you're talking about Pam Smart, an adult, who has committed a heinous crime, we equate the crime with the human being. And that's where our problem is. We make the face of the crime that person so much so that nothing else about the person matters. And that's a problem if you really want justice. So I think that the narrative that gets created impacts a kind of pressure, even though certainly a judge is supposed to be impartial, certainly a jury is supposed to be impartial. But there's a pressure in a community and a fury in a community, and we see it over and over again with a narrative created that even if people haven't been there, they believe the narrative. They hear their friends say, oh, in Carter's case, he high-fived Gator after the crime, or, oh, the boys were joyful after the murder, which was a headline of the newspaper. And that kind of I don't know if the word is prejudice or scapegoatism or misrepresentation before something is proven. Is a problem.
Yeah, it really is. And I guess the word prejudice, it really means that, you know, prejudice, you know, before judging. Mm-hmm. And perhaps one of the most important aspects of your book, Boy with a Knife, is what you reveal about why young people engage in crime and violence. Mm-hmm. What is known and accepted today that wasn't known when the push to treat juveniles as adults came into being?
Right. That's another thing that's fascinating for me, because, of course, I didn't know this myself when I started undertaking this research, and really when I even started writing Carter, I didn't know it. I think things were evolving so much. That was in 2007 when I got the first letter from him. Things were evolving a lot. The Supreme Court was just beginning to base cases on this new neuroscience that we were discovering, that uh-huh. things like the actual size of the brain of a juvenile is different than the size of an adult, that the behavior, that the part of the brain that matures as late possibly as 26, that can be responsible for decisions that are rational, that can be responsible for not being as subjected to peer pressure or to rash actions, to impulsive actions, that all of that research was not in our consciousness then. And so when Carter went to trial, and I think this is so interesting, that he was judged not amenable to change. That was the term used. And that's so different than the way we see kids today. I will say, however, that the more horrible the crime is, the more people refuse to let in anything that is real about neuroscience. The crime seems to trump the understanding of juvenile behavior.
Yeah, it's important how, you know, kids developing brains are very, very significant. And it's one reason why I kind of think the driver's license should be 25 for boys and 18 for girls, maybe, because I think, sort of kidding, but brains are still developing in that way. Now, as I read about this, Carter's friend Gator was influential in the eventual murder that was committed. That reminded me of the influence we read about the elder Saneyev brother in the Boston Marathon bombing on his younger brother. How often do such situations come up when a young teen such as Carter commits some horrible crime as he did? And how might this be factored into the sentencing and any kind of hope for rehabilitation?
Well, in terms of your first question, that's really interesting, because I just read a study, and I don't have the exact number, but the number of kids who commit a crime and particularly who commit a crime like murder, a more heinous crime, are often, and it could be as much as 40%, accompanied by an older person. Now, older could be 18, right, age of adulthood in the state, or it could be 22, or it could be 25. We don't have those stats.
But it's somebody they look up to.
Older is significant.
Yes. Hmm? It's somebody that they look up to.
Somebody they look up to, or if I guess we can say, or somebody they are influenced by, and age probably plays a part in it. And in Carter's case, Gator was the same age as Carter, but he definitely was more outlandish. He was more outgoing and outrageous, and Carter got a kick out of that in some kind of, some part of him, and went along with his escapade, so to speak.
So how can this understanding be factored into not only sentencing, but the possibility of real rehabilitation?
Well, I think we have to look at the I think that stat that you just mentioned is really important. I've seen different juvenile justice people in D.C. say, we've got to do something about this. We have to make this clear. This is pretty new that we're just finding this out. So I don't think we've yet pushed this to law. What has happened is that, and law, as you know, is so slow to change. I mean, we're just recovering from having made incredibly harsh laws from the super predator years. Now, since we have Miller v. Alabama, we have juveniles that must be sentenced with eligibility for parole, as opposed to life without parole. So many cases in different states are either being retried, or those kids are coming up, they're not kids anymore, but they're coming up for parole, and they must get a chance at parole. Doesn't mean they'll get out, but they'll get the opportunity for parole.
Yeah.
So those things are happening. But I will tell you, it's not across the board positive. Some of the states are very positive,
mm-hmm.
but for example, in Missouri, they're working with a bill where they want opportunity for parole in 50 years for a kid. Now,
wow.
50 years, that's almost like a life sentence, in my opinion. So how can we say that's meaningful opportunity to change?
Mm. And, people get, when there's a heinous crime, such as Carter did commit, mm-hmm. People get angry. There's a big difference between revenge and justice. A very big difference.
Absolutely.
Not everybody gets that. How can convicted murderers who caused loss of life expect to be treated humanely? What was the hardest part for you about capturing Carter's humanity? And maybe you can talk about revenge versus justice in that answer.
I'm really glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of statistical evidence that's very interesting, and that is a study was done that people who have committed murder, second-degree murder, several different states did this study, those who've gotten out are the least likely people to go back to crime. Now, why is that so? Okay, one reason may be that, as you were just mentioning about anger, the crime of passion was in an aberration, was a horrible thing that happened. And so when they're, when they have time to consider that,
right.
when they have time to think about them, what they've done,
right.
they come to understand that they have to change their anger, or change their behavior, change their way of being, and they work on it. So that's one thing. Excuse me. Secondly, I think there is a process of growing up which happens with people, which we somehow don't take into account when we're sentencing kids. Kids age out of crime. That is another statistic that's very interesting. We don't, other countries take this into account. They might give a kid 10 or 15 years for a horrible crime, whereas we we want to give them life. We have still that notion that, an eye for an eye, life, you take a life, you get a life, that kind of thinking. It's very hard to change that kind of thinking, and you mentioned revenge, but healing has to be the way we go in this society, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'm for restorative justice. I'm for mm-hmm. anything that helps us come to some kind of peace with ourselves as well as with what has happened to us. And I think we're very bad at that in this country.
Yeah.
We seem to, fan the flames rather than try to cool the flames when terrible things happen.
Yeah, and it's like this has become a punishment culture. Just punishment right. after punishment, and that's very different from justice. The idea right. of justice has, at least in my mind, always been keeping the public safe, but also rehabilitating, bringing this person to be able to be back in society again. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here on Keeping Democracy Alive. We're speaking with author Gene Traunstein. The new book is called Boy with a Knife. Traunstein is the author of the highly praised Shakespeare Behind Bars, and has written a lot about prison issues for many publications, including The Globe, Boston, and lots of other outlets. And this is an important issue, changing sentencing of juveniles. Unlike 194 other countries, the U.S., along with Somalia and South Sudan, not exactly great examples, the U.S. has not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child. What rights does this international treaty provide, and how might this actually be useful in bringing out real justice when it comes to juveniles?
Well, right, children actually have a right to a trial. They have a right to face their accusers. They have a right to their own attorney. They have a right to stand up for themselves, and they have a right to safe treatment. They have a right to not be housed, not fear rape, not fear abuse, to be treated as children, I guess, is the best way of saying it. And mm-hmm. that, it is interesting that we haven't, I don't really understand why we haven't signed it. I know that the United States would say there would be some glitch or something that we haven't solved. I mean, just now, President Obama this year came out yes. with children cannot be put in solitary in federal prisons. That's not true in states. So even though we might call it in juvenile facilities room consignment, in our country, there are kids put in solitary. That's inhumane. It's considered inhumane in most countries. We allow that. Why do we allow that? I mean, if you ask me, I think we have a very strong guard union. I think people want want leverage, but it's inhumane. It's inhumane for anybody to be in solitary. I'd go crazy if somebody put me in a cell for 48 hours without anything to do.
Of course.
So, I think it's, and then imagine being 15 or 16.
Yeah, and the institutional aspect of it, you mentioned the correctional union, correctional association. Mm-hmm. What are, the guards, the people in charge, they have a tremendous amount of power over the those imprisoned, which itself is a big question. But I wonder about politically how much power they may have and what harm that may do to mm-hmm. young people who are trying to get better and come back into society.
Well, it's so interesting. I don't know if you saw 60 Minutes on Germany's prisons a few weeks ago.
I did not.
But I made all my students watch it because uh-huh. I said, you have to take a look at this. But one of the things that the head of the prison said is that punishment is not part of the equation. Hmm. I thought that was fascinating, that the entire intention is to treat people, to heal them, to help them be better so they can come back out, quote, into the world. And what that means is that the guards have to have psychology training. They actually are trained for 2 years. Our guards, 8-9 weeks, maybe 10 weeks, that's our training for correction officers. That's phenomenally different.
Yeah, that's really rough stuff, and a lot of harm comes from that. Should any juveniles be sentenced as adults? And before you answer that, those who commit crimes, even if they're underage, obviously they got to be held accountable for their actions. Mm-hmm. So instead of incarceration, what might you suggest?
Well, first of all, I think many, many people can be kept at home with programs, with monitoring, mm-hmm. I go for programmatic help as opposed to, taking things away from people. I think that they probably need more services rather than fewer services. They probably need more psychotherapy. They need, different kind of education. They might need smaller classes. They might need work, different ways in which they are productive in a community, taking part in groups. Missouri has a fantastic way they now treat kids, and they, certainly there are some kids who need more security, more containment, who are considered unsafe to be outside. Mm-hmm. But even those kids are gradually sort of brought back into the world, brought into town. Things happen where they get certain kinds of programs that lower security kids get more early on. So, there's steps, there are ways of doing it to bring the kids back, but not these big, the juvenile facilities, the big juvenile facilities don't work, and certainly prisons where adults are don't work. They don't work for kids. They don't give them what they need to come back into the world. Carter was a lucky one in a way. And still, even though he's back, he's had job difficulties, integration issues, in certain kinds of ways. I mean, you know, how easy is it to be a tutor when he, even though he's graduated from a community college with a 4.0 average? It's not. No one's going to hire him to tutor kids, even though he's really should be a tutor because he's so smart. But the kinds of things that have happened to him are in spite of prison, and the fact that he is able to overcome barriers is a testament to his character, but the barriers are there.
And there are lots of other kids who are not such outstanding, you know, achievers there, but they deserve justice too.
And exactly.
As you were describing
their
it.
Their father.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Didn't have their father in prison with him. I want to say that. Another thing, his father was in prison with him at one point.
His father was in prison with him.
Right.
And that helped him?
Because his father kind of showed him the ropes in a certain way and told him not to pay attention to this person.
Oh, wow.
You know, his father was, he wasn't even in the same prison, but he got a letter from his father. Father told him what to do, and then was in the same prison with his father for a year. But my point is that a kid who goes to an adult facility has no clue what is going to happen. It's just terrifying.
Yeah.
And so what do? You can maybe get in with gangs, or you put on a front, or you get hurt. I mean, what else can happen to you but some sort of manipulation?
Horrible things. Well, if listeners want to learn more and to help bring about change, the book is called Boy with a Knife, and our guest again is Gene Traunstein. But what else can people do? Where else can people go to look into this and to do something?
In terms of resources, I think that there are wonderful juvenile justice organizations all around the country that you can read up on and you can find out about. All you have to do is just today, for example, just on the Marshall Project, they're having a talk on juvenile justice. Find out what's going on in New Hampshire with your laws. Where does New Hampshire stand on how long kids have to stay in an adult prison, or what age they go to an adult prison? Do they go, as in Massachusetts, they go automatically if someone has committed murder, they are automatically tried as an adult at age 14. So find out what's going on in your state, and I think that's a really important step.
Well, thank you so much. I know you have to run off and teach a class. Thanks so much, Gene Traunstein, for being with us and shedding some light on this important issue that normally just gets shoved in the dark. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation, Bert.
All right. And thank you. We'll be back in just a couple minutes talking about a cover-up of cholera. Yes.
Excuse me, everybody. Won't you gather around? I got something to say.
Yo, who is this?
It's just a guy who looks at things differently, the way things are, aren't always how they're meant to be. With the big men here in the bullpen, I don't want my knees to take a full bend. Step back, ask yourself, can it wait? Or do you want to become an AIDS candidate? Take your eyes off me. Don't even watch the kid, or you'll go out like Liberace did. In my own cell, I could have been alone. What do y'all want me? I'm only skin and bone. I'm feeling faint. It's kind of hot. My, what big muscles you got. Ooh, lips don't fail me now. Until play comes to
hey,
fail me.
Hey, what's going on here?
Man, this is too much. Look, but don't touch. I'm just trying to avoid the bum rush. Thought I was in here with murderers and stranglers. You guys are a bunch of rump wranglers. And why me? Look, I'm not the only male.
We gon' tie that fade into a ponytail.
Yo, this is a no-go. I'ma call a CO. Me a homo? Nah, man, that's a no-no. But if you back off now, that might save your time. Off your sense for good behavior. I'm speaking from the heart, from the center. The sign on my ass says, do not enter. I'm a rapper. I rock rhymes, so I'ma bust one. I see y'all wanna rock, like Hudson. Just an example. I chill him and thrill him. Where is play? I'ma kill him.
All right, Songbird, you hit the right note. You just made bail.
Hey, fellas, I gotta go. Don't feel bad. All right, no, hey, no long faces.
Think of all the fun we had. I want to thank y'all for making me feel welcome. It really, really did the trick.
Juvenile in prison there. Yikes, maybe we can change that. Well, we're going to switch gears and talk about a cover-up of cholera. What could that possibly be? How does something like that happen? Well, throughout the last 200 years or so, the powerful nations of the world have maintained their influence over smaller, less developed nations as that it's beneficent. It's good for us to maintain our power over them. In spreading civilization, these lesser nations are receiving gifts from us. How has that worked out? Well, in January 2010, you probably remember an earthquake of magnitude 7.0 hit Haiti. And of course, that wasn't anyone's fault. Of course, it was a terrible disaster, and the world's most powerful nations naturally went in to help. Many have asked how much help the world has brought. They promised new housing, for example, but it oftentimes did not appear at all, and who knows where that money went. But one thing did appear after the earthquake that was not there before: cholera. Yes, cholera. In October 2010, 9 months after the massive earthquake that devastated Haiti, a second disaster began to unfold, soon to become the world's largest cholera epidemic in modern times. In a country that never before reported any cholera, the epidemic mysteriously and simultaneously appeared in river communities of central Haiti, eventually triggering nearly 800,000 cases and 9,000 deaths. The epidemic has now reached nearly every corner of that beleaguered, terribly impoverished nation. But before the earthquake, there had been zero diagnosed cases of cholera in Haiti. In fact, there had never been a diagnosed case in that country ever before. The specific strain of cholera did not spring up naturally. It had to be brought in, and brought in it was. In the case of Haiti, it came from United Nations peacekeepers. Of course, not intentionally. This portion of Keeping Democracy Alive is not about the unfortunate cholera outbreak. It's about the unfortunate cover-up. The Centers for Disease Control, a U.S. government agency, discouraged journalists from asking about the epidemic's origin. Since the first days of the epidemic, the United Nations, it seems, has tried to cover up what it did. Everyone from the soldiers on the base to Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has been implicated. The Obama administration and the U.S. government did not want the UN to be held accountable because doing so might persuade other people elsewhere to hold U.S. peacekeeping missions accountable. And because the U.S. Foots a quarter of the United Nations bill, peacekeeping budget. Our guest on this part of Keeping Democracy Alive is Ralph R. Frerichs, Professor Emeritus of Epidemiology at UCLA. He's consulted on epidemiological and management-related issues and many international agencies, including the Albert Schweitzer Foundation, Population Council, UN, WHO, USAID, and CDC in 16 countries. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Frerichs. I assume it is Frerichs?
Frerichs it is. Thank you very much, Bert. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, as we said, in 2010, January, an earthquake of catastrophic magnitude hit Haiti. About how many people were affected, and how long after the earthquake did the world's greatest cholera epidemic tear through that country? How many more lives were lost because of that?
Well, a lot of people thought that the two were associated. They did have this huge, huge outbreak, earthquake that occurred in January, and hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives. In fact, the exact number is still being debated. Right. And at the time, they even talked about that with this terrible event that there was probably going to be disease outbreaks and the like that followed. And then, lo and behold, 9 months later, when a cholera outbreak occurred, many people thought that it was related to the earthquake.
Sure.
You know, time goes fairly quickly in people's minds and such. And so they thought, oh, here's another event, and it's probably earthquake associated. But those in the know realized that that time interval was a bit long for an association.
Hmm.
And that, as it turned out, that these were two independent events, that it was just another one of those hardships that came along. And it had just, in fact, shortly after the cholera outbreak came in mid-October, then in early November, all of a sudden there was a huge hurricane, that Hurricane Tomas that affected the country as well. And so it was just like one event after another in 2010. It was definitely a terrible year for these people in this impoverished country.
And I can imagine, as you say, people thought, oh, well, it's just another disaster in this incredibly impoverished country. And maybe not that much attention was paid to it. And I should mention, you have written a quite a book about it called Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti. Apparently, the Centers for Disease Control actually refused to take environmental samples from around the United Nations Peacekeepers base or test the soldiers during the small window when doing so would have been worthwhile. What? Why would they refuse to take environmental samples from around the UN Peacekeepers base?
Well, you're absolutely right. It was a very unusual start. Usually, as an epidemiologist, I mean, I'm a... was sitting here in my retirement, minding my own business. I was teaching a class still at UCLA, a summer class on epidemiology. And I'm always looking around for examples of interesting outbreaks and things that happen and such. And so this cholera outbreak in Haiti caught my eye. And again, it was unusual. And I knew that cholera hadn't appeared in the Caribbean before. And so it was a bit unusual in that respect. But the thing that really got my attention was when all of a sudden I was reading these comments by the cholera expert from WHO, from the cholera experts from CDC and others, that somehow or another, how this disease came to the island or to the country of Haiti, how that occurred was that they were too busy, that they couldn't look into it, that they it wasn't the time right now to do it. And that what they were too busy was attending people, helping people with their lives, the medical care, and so on and so forth. Now, the medical care argument for CDC epidemiologists was the most unusual of all, because epidemiologists are widely known as, by their more popular name, as disease detectives.
Yeah.
And if you can imagine, if there'd been some kind of mass shooting or something, and people come in to investigate exactly the detectives, investigate exactly what it is that occurred, you wouldn't expect them to be patching up the victims and dealing with them and hauling them off to the hospital. That's what other people do.
Right.
The detectives are there to detect. And to hear epidemiologists from CDC or from the Pan American Health Organization, which is the regional arm of the World Health Organization, say that somehow or another, this aspect of what they do is inappropriate, was startling.
I
was truly startled. And once you get startled, then you know that something is not quite right.
Yes.
And I didn't know at the time what wasn't quite right, but it perked me up. And I started paying much, much closer attention to the whole process, what was going on.
And so, being a detective yourself, what did you find about, so they said they did refuse to take environmental samples. They didn't want to look into it. You must have dug into it a little more.
Well, I didn't know at first what it is that they did or didn't do. I just knew that they had this unusual comment that they made. And or comments that they were making and such, and the reaction to the press. Now, it turns out that there were enterprising journalists who were around.
Oh, that's cool.
And these enterprising journalists were snooping about, and they found that there was an association with Nepalese peacekeepers, the UN peacekeepers who had come from Nepal, and that there had been an outbreak of cholera earlier in Nepal, and that it was associated with them. But they were journalists, and journalists, even though you and I and most others know that they are extremely valuable people who provide us lots of important information, others at times denigrate them and say, oh, they're just passing along rumors and such. So the first thing that came out about the journalists, that these were just rumors, that these weren't really facts and such. But CDC and the Pan American Health Organization, they still refused to send in an actual epidemiologist to do an investigation. And the Haitian government, seeing what was unfolding, decided that they would reach out to France. Uh-huh. And that they're a former French colony, but independent since 1804.
Yeah.
And so they reached out to France, and they asked them if they could provide an epidemiologist to investigate not only the onset of cholera, but also, you know, how it's spreading, why it's spreading the way it is throughout the country. And answering that call was a physician from Marseille, a man named Renaud Perrault, who is a French epidemiologist who also has a PhD in infectious diseases. So he's a very well-educated man. But his focus was really not primarily on cholera. His main focus was on fungal diseases and parasitic diseases. But he had this unusual, hobby, is that in his spare time, he would go out and work with nonprofit NGOs, the group specially known as Doctors of the World.
Uh-huh.
Doctors Without Borders is the main French organization that people know about, but there's also another called Doctors of the World. And he would work with them. And along the way, in earlier years, he had been in Goma in Africa in the mid-90s, after the Rwandan genocide.
Uh-huh.
And he was serving as a pediatrician there in a refugee camp. And all of a sudden, they had this huge cholera outbreak. And he saw the devastation that cholera did. And he became very interested in cholera. And not just in cholera, the organism, but in cholera, how epidemics come about, how they spread, what are their characteristics and such. So he became studying this more closely and developed a reputation in France. People knew that this was his interest. He did some publications on it. And when the Haitian government made contact, they suggested Renaud Perrault. And Renaud patched up his affairs that he was working and such, and a couple of weeks later showed up in early November in Port-au-Prince and started his investigation.
So what is curious, starting to be curious here, I mean, that's a curious pastime hobby he has, but his take on the origin of the outbreak was met with resistance and denial, as you write about. Why?
Right away.
Why?
Right away from the beginning. And at first he overlooked it. He's a real straight shooter. He's one of these straightforward guys. And at first he overlooked it. He thought maybe, you know, people were maybe didn't understand it right, what they were saying, and so on and so forth. But then after a while, the pattern became clear to him. And he studied more carefully what the journalist had said. He visited the camp, visited the area, traveled throughout the country, studying exactly how cholera had occurred, the pattern that was unraveling and such, and made up his own mind, and in fact was just about finishing his tour when a mysterious package showed up.
Uh-oh.
And that mysterious package was an initial epidemiologic report of a team from Haiti that had gone out immediately after the outbreak started and had done their initial investigation. And that report was suppressed.
Hmm.
It never reached the light of day.
Why? Why?
It now was handed in this brown envelope to Renaud the day before he was to leave Port-au-Prince and return home to France. He had not yet written his final report, but this was part of it. A little later on, another smaller package came to him. This was a set of analyses that the Haitian laboratory had done of early cholera cases and the location of those cholera cases, which was near the Nepalese base. So this was a very how do we say, these two items, the cholera samples
were
analyzed and the Haitian report. He added those to his report, and it became a blockbuster when it came out.
Uh-huh. And why would there be a cover-up? What powers would there be in wanting to cover it up?
Well, he wondered about that, too. I entered into the picture a short while after all this. After his report had come out, I was translating his report and putting it on a website that I created for this, wondering exactly the same sorts of thing that you're talking about. But I still didn't have much insight on why, you know, what the larger picture was in this regard. I was more fascinated at the time with the mystery of what it is that happened, this French epidemiologist, what he did, and so forth. And I reached out to him via email in January of 2011, and it was probably at the lowest point in his investigation. Everybody was criticizing him, wasn't receiving it. There's a lot of suspicion going around and such. And I immediately hit it off with him. We visited several times in the ensuing years and whatnot. And the more we talked, the more we communicated by email and all that, the more I realized that there was a bigger picture. And the bigger picture that you alluded to in your fine introduction was one that became increasingly apparent. And that, I think, was the second part of the book. The first part of the book is the investigation itself and how a French epidemiologist would study things like this. And again, for people who are interested in a good detective story, this is the first part. But the second part came when it was apparent that there was a cover-up, and we got into the broader policy implications that that came into play. And I think that that's what brought all kinds of people into this story. And this is the first time, this book is the first time that all of these elements are brought together in a single source, and that people get an idea of what the big picture was, of what it is that was going on.
As Nixon said, it's not the action that gets you in trouble, it's the cover-up, trying to cover it up. And as Mark Twain said, there are three kinds of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oddly enough,
and
you're absolutely right that there was a huge cover-up. It's oddly enough, it wasn't just the lies, damn lies, and statistics. It was the lies, damn lies, and altered maps.
Yes. Tell us about that. That's fascinating.
Go ahead. You had here, right from the beginning, there was a big debate. I mean, there was an underlying debate that immediately came to the fore on cholera. And there were two strains of thought, one in the scientific community, one that this was a disease that arose from the environment,
right,
and that cholera is a waterborne organism,
right,
and that there was some kind of transformation of this organism in the estuaries off the coastal town of St. Mark, and that this started an epidemic in St. Mark, in the coastal region of St. Mark. And because it was an environmental transformation and so forth, that there was great innocence. There wasn't anybody, nobody was at fault. It was like the earthquake. It was just one of those terrible events that occurred, or like a great storm or whatnot. The other theory, and this is the one that Renan Perot held, was that cholera had come through human activity. And the human activity people centered their attention on the town of Mirebalais, which is a city that's in the interior of the country, and next to it is situated a UN base. The UN had been in Haiti as a peacekeeping force since 2004, and they had people from various countries throughout the world who would come and serve for 6 months at a time as peacekeepers. And this post that was in the Mirebalais area, in the interior of the area, was one in which they had people from Nepal, that soldiers from Nepal,
right,
that were serving there. So you had this theory that it was either the innocence theory coming from the Caribbean, out of the waters and so forth, or that there was somebody was culpable, and that these were potentially UN peacekeepers coming from a foreign land. So the UN and many others thought that this innocence theory was pretty good. The environmental theory is good theory. And while others thought that the well, wait a minute, it looks more like that this human activity theory could be at play, but there were consequences if the human activity theory were at play, namely that these involved the most exalted institution in the world, the UN, a revered institution that is known for doing good work and caring and so on and so forth, and all of a sudden people were implying that this noble organization had somehow or another done something wrong. And it was much easier to accept the alternative that no, this was an environmental problem, that this is something that came from the environment. So if you wanted to believe in the environment, you had to believe that it all started around coastal St. Mark.
So they changed
the
map.
You believed in the human activity and the peacekeepers and so forth and all, you would focus on Mirbele in the interior. So these two cities were the focal point, and the maps, if the maps could direct your attention to St. Mark, favored the environmental theories.
Mm-hmm.
If the maps, on the other hand, told the truthful picture that all this started close to Mirbele, it suggested UN peacekeepers. So along the way, the maps got distorted by the agencies that were making maps.
Unbelievable.
In subtle ways. Not the maps basically themselves, but the way the maps were arranged, the way the legends spoke out about it and such, and that these, again, are revealed. These alterations of maps are also revealed in the book.
Fascinating. So there is a class action lawsuit seeking recompense from the United Nations. How has the UN reacted? They must not be real pleased with that.
Well, as the there were several reporters that were at work on this, and they persisted, and very persistent. And the book also gives a great shout out to these enterprising reporters, and so they pushed things along. And soon, a human rights group that's based in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and is based in Boston, linked together, and they put forward a lawsuit, feeling that the UN, that there was sufficient evidence based on what the reporters had said, based on what Bernard Perrault's report had said, and subsequent journal article had said, and then other scientific investigations came in and such, and the human rights group felt that there was sufficient evidence there to show that the UN was culpable of negligence at least, and they put forward a lawsuit. And Bernard had nothing to do with the lawsuit. I mean, it's off to the side, but it was another thing that kept this in the forefront, because the people who did the lawsuit were prominent human rights people. So now you had a lawsuit against an organization that prides itself on being a human rights organization. And it was an interesting, it still is, a very interesting situation.
And
the UN at first, stonewalled, tried to alter the evidence, attempted to suggest that, you know, this was part of the innocence theory, not the the peacekeepers theory, the innocent environmental theory, not the other. But the evidence just became increasingly overwhelming, and eventually it all went to court, and the U.S. showed up.
Uh-oh.
Turned out that the UN didn't go to court. The UN were the ones who were being considered in court, but the U.S. ended up representing the UN, and it turns out that there was a big involvement by the United States in this. And the United States involvement became even clearer. In fact, when looking at their website, that a month before this cholera outbreak started, they had emphasized that UN peacekeeping is a wonderful activity, saves money, cost-effective way to keep peace around the world, and it's an important aspect of UN foreign policy. And so now, all of a sudden, the UN, or the U.S., seeing that this important aspect of foreign policy was being challenged, ended up in the curious position of defending the UN against the human rights organization, which was trying to have or provide reparations for individuals in the poorest country in the hemisphere for wrongs that had been done them by this initial action.
Absolutely amazing. The book is called Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti. And our guest today is the author, Ralph Frericks. And we're talking about that. And what would you conclude about the world's wealthiest nations, non-governmental agencies, and other international institutions, how they respond when their interests end up clashing with the needs of the world's poorest and most vulnerable people? It's such an interesting
situation. I'd say not well. I think that the NGOs worry a lot about security and so that they can go about doing their good work. Everybody talks about the higher good, that they want to be able to do their good work in Haiti. The UN talks about doing their good work in Haiti. But along the way, somehow or another, they forgot the basic element, that one of trust, is that if it turns out that when something goes wrong, that you're not able to accept responsibility and deal with what went wrong, then people start distrusting you. And I think that element of trust, distrust, has come into this, into play in this situation. And what we're basically trying to do with the book is to bring, first of all, a truthful revelation of what it is that occurred, and then let the reader and others decide where things go next.
So do you think your book may end up pressuring the UN and other entities to cooperate more transparently with scientists in the future?
That part is never clear. You know, the future always has kind of a vague thing. I think it's another example, like when you mentioned earlier with Nixon and such people. You always thought politicians would understand exactly about the elements of cover-up, but cover-ups followed thereafter, right and left. And I think is that in this case, you know, it's such a huge cover-up that occurred, and it's occurred in an unusual settings. It occurred, some journalists participated, great institutions like the UN, with the World Health Organization, others, CDC, Centers for Disease Control, got involved in the politics of this. And I think that there has to be some sorting out after the book gets people talking about it, that I think that there has to be some sorting out in these agencies, and they have to decide is how in the future they will respond to this kind of things when inevitable mistakes occur.
Yes.
And to step forward and deal with it in a truthful, transparent manner, and not try to hide things away.
Absolutely amazing. You would think that would be clear. The book is called Deadly River, Cholera and Cover-Up in Post-Earthquake Haiti. Our guest has been author Ralph Frericks. Thanks so much for being with us, and hopefully we can learn from this and take responsibility. What a concept.
Well, it's indeed been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And truth can be uncomfortable.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things.
John Lennon on Wanting Truth.
Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of Tricky Dick is gonna mother her, but stop so meek, but just a pocket full of hope. Money for dough. Money for
The cover-up always gets you in the end.